Good morning.
Good morning.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial, KBOO.FM, if you're listening on the web. My name is Cecil Prescott.
I'm Celeste Carey, and if you're listening in the Gorge, it would be at 91.9, and then the Willamette River Valley, 100.7. Good morning and welcome to More Talk Radio.
Today is Monday, December 21st, and that means one special thing. Spring is coming. So the days are getting longer.
That's right. See, he's finally caught on to my logic. So therefore, first day of winter, here you go. Now the days are longer. We will prevail.
Well, with that good perspective and attitude, we thank you for listening and joining us this morning. We're hosting a discussion on the issue of religious clothing in public schools. In this past spring, Oregon legislature passed Senate Bill 786, which made changes in the law. And this special session, I believe, there is a proposal to include teachers in this, and which will no longer prohibit teachers from wearing religious garb in the school. Joining us to clarify the issues about this issue are Kevin Finney, who is currently Public Policy Director of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. Kevin has worked as a political director for Oregon League of Conservation Voters, Outreach Coordinator with the Union of Concerned Scientists in California, and Climate Change Program Director with the Coalition for Clean Air. Also joining us is Oregon Attorney Charlie Hinkle, who has been lead counsel in many landmark decisions construing the Oregon Constitution in areas of religious liberty, open courts, commercial speech, election laws, and property rights. He is one of the most active and prominent cooperating attorneys for the American Civil Liberties Union in Oregon. And gentlemen, we thank you for joining us this morning.
Nice to be here.
Pleasure.
All righty. Thank you.
So let's begin. I thought we might begin with a little opener in terms of clarification of the issues. And maybe I'll ask this first question to Mr. Hinkle, just in terms of when we talk about religion and things like that, I think we need to first look at the Constitution. And maybe you can give us a very basic insight about what the Oregon Constitution say about religion, and is there a religious clause or exemption in the Oregon Constitution?
Yes, the Oregon Constitution, like the federal Constitution, has a religious liberty clause. In fact, the Oregon Constitution has two of them, guaranteeing everybody the right to free exercise of religion, freedom of opinion, freedom of worship. So we have a very strong constitutional protection for individual choice in matters of religion. That's the free exercise side. Then the federal constitution has also what is known as the Establishment Clause, which says that Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. There's big controversy about what that means, but essentially the gist of it is that government is supposed to keep its nose out of religion, and religion is supposed to keep its nose out of government. Now, the Oregon Constitution doesn't have a specific establishment clause. What it does have is a no money clause. What the Oregon Constitution says is that no money shall be drawn from the public treasury for the benefit of any religious institution. So there's been very little litigation under that clause. There was a case in the early 60s that said that clause in the Oregon Constitution prevents a public school from loaning textbooks to a Roman Catholic school. Then a little later, there was a case that said the Milwaukee School District had violated the statute or the Constitution when it paid for algebra teachers or something like that to go into the local Roman Catholic school and teach secular subjects in a Catholic school. And then the third principal case was the graduation prayer case. The Oregon Court of Appeals has said that the no public money to support religion clause means that you cannot have vocal public prayer at a high school graduation. So that's the sort of the constitutional terrain in Oregon. On the one hand, there's protection for free exercise of religion, as there is in the federal constitution. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there's the notion that government should not support religion, shouldn't oppose religion, should just keep its nose out of religion.
I'm afraid that I may be jumping ahead just a little bit, but can you give us a little bit of clarity as to what's the time frame for the establishment of these two clauses?
Well, those two clauses in the Constitution that I've been referring to have been part of the Oregon Constitution since it was written in 1857. Now, the issue that you all have invited us here for this morning, and that Kevin and I have been debating in a couple other forums as well, doesn't relate specifically or directly to the Constitution. It relates to a statute.
Right.
And do you want me to describe that?
Well, I wanted to kind of lead into it sideways.
Okay.
Now, if that second clause, the Establishment Clause, did not support religion with public money, and if I understood you correctly, it also did not oppose religion, correct?
Right.
How is it that we were able to, or how is it that it came about that we ended up with the 1923 Guard Bill and the Compulsory Education Act, which, if I understand correctly, is kind of what led us to where we are now?
Well, that's a good question.
Because one of them is opposing religion.
That's right. And the Oregon Supreme Court has said very specifically that the Garb Bill, which originated in 1923 and then was reenacted in 1965, that the Religious Dress Bill is specifically directed at religion. There's no question about that.
Mm-hmm.
So when a law is neutral, across the board, applies to everybody, and simply has an impact on religion, then there's a pretty strong presumption that that law is permissible. I mean, for example, if there's a law that says nobody can have multiple marriages, that has a disproportionate impact on certain Mormons who believe that they should be engaged in polygamy. Nevertheless, the law itself is not aimed at religion. It is simply aimed at stabilizing marriage or whatever rationale you might come up with. But, you know, it's not directed specifically at religion. In contrast, this law is specifically addressed to religion because it says no person who is a public school teacher shall wear religious dress in the course of their duties as a public school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't say you can't wear non-religious dress. So it's not a neutral law by any means. It's a targeted at religion.
That's true, but it also arose either parallel to or connected to the Compulsory Public Education Act, which said, oh, and by the way, there will be no more religious schools.
That's right.
You can't even wear your religious garb in your school because we're doing away with your schools.
And it came out of that same historical era. The ban on parochial schools went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and
mm-hmm.
they struck down that law
right.
And said that people have the right to send their kids to parochial schools, to religious schools, if they want. So at about that same time, then, this religious garb statute comes into play, and that, interestingly, it was not challenged until 1985. And that's when the Oregon Supreme Court heard a challenge to the law by a Sikh teacher. She was a woman who had converted to the Sikh religion, and she was a teacher in middle school in Eugene, I think maybe 7th or 8th grade, something like that, in the Eugene public schools. And when she converted to her new religion of Sikhism, she wanted to wear the characteristic white garment that many Sikhs wear, and in addition, the turban. I think probably most of us are more familiar with the turban as a indication of the Sikh religion. We've all seen politicians in India. I think the current Prime Minister of India, as a matter of fact, they used a picture of him in the paper the other day with Obama at the climate change, and he's wearing his turban. So the Sikhs, they're very strong, very prominent religion in India, and now, of course, there are many here in America as well, and they wear their turban. So she wanted to be a public school teacher. She wanted to wear her turban in the classroom. The statute prevented that. So she sued to challenge the statute, and the Oregon Supreme Court said that the state had a valid interest in maintaining the religious neutrality of the classroom. And so, yes, even though this statute targets religion, that's the very point of maintaining religious neutrality. You target religion, and you say you can wear any other kind of clothing that you want, but you cannot wear clothing that communicates a religious message. That's the principle behind the statute, and the Oregon Supreme Court said that that was justifiable under the Constitution. She appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court essentially affirmed, said that there was no, she did not present a substantial federal constitutional question. So as it stands right now, the Oregon garb statute is constitutional. So the question before the legislature come February is not going to be a constitutional argument so much as a policy argument. Is this a good policy for the state of Oregon to have, even though the constitutional issue seems to be decided? But that, of course, doesn't mean that the law cannot be repealed if the legislature wants it to be repealed.
We're speaking this morning with Charlie Hinkle and Kevin Finney. The topic this morning is the discussion, the proposal before the February legislature in terms of enacting a law which will permit teachers in public school to wear religious garb. The voice you heard before was Charlie Hinkle, and I thought we might want to bring in Kevin Finney at this time. Kevin, you worked with Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, and I was wondering if you could give us some current history of the Senate Bill 786, why and who sought to enact that law initially, and then I have a follow-up with that.
Right. This was a bill introduced by House Speaker Dave Hunt, and what this bill essentially did was to set a higher standard for the protection of religious freedom in the workplace. So it said that if you were a worker and wanted to take off a religious holiday from work and you had some leave time available that you could take, that the employer basically had to be more deferential to your desire to do that unless there was a very strong reason that the employer could not allow that without really, you know, causing a disruption of the workplace in some way. And the same thing on wearing religious apparel in the workplace. But as part of this legislation, there was an exemption left in place for public school teachers that they were not provided this higher standard of protection for religious liberty in the workplace that other employees would get. Now, this this came to light early this summer, this past summer, after the legislation had passed the legislature and prior to the governor deciding to sign the bill, that this exemption caused a lot of concern for members of the Sikh community, members of the Muslim community, some observant Jews, and others who felt that this really resulted in hiring discrimination. It basically precluded people who wore any kind of religious attire from being able to get jobs as teachers in the public schools. And for this reason, should be this statute, which, by the way, is one of only three states in the country that has a statute banning the wearing of religious attire statewide. So the feeling was this is a discriminatory statute. We should remove it. It's much broader than it needs to be. And in this sort of period of discriminating in hiring for teachers against those who wear religious attire.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of, I'm just interested in, you said after the legislation was passed, and it seems as if it was an afterthought that in terms of teachers, that the issue wasn't raised until after the law was passed by certain individuals, or why wasn't it included initially?
Why was it not included initially?
There are different stories told about why it was included initially. My sense was that in the 1987 session, when the bill first was debated and went through some amendments, that was put in at the request then of the ACLU, and then just kind of carried over when it was reintroduced in the 2009 session. Did I say the 2000 originally the 2007 session?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So, in which case, it wasn't an afterthought then necessarily.
No, I wouldn't say it was an afterthought. Mm-hmm. I think it was my sense was that it was included originally because it was felt that we could not pass the legislation extending religious liberty to everybody in the other workplaces without including this exemption for public school teachers. But now, mm-hmm. in a new context, and now that the issue has come to light and there's been more public discussion about it, Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon is supporting the effort to repeal the statute, ORS 342-650, and its companion statute, which is basically enforcement provisions or sanctions, does amount to the statewide ban, and we think that that will open up the process of hiring to individuals who do wear some religious attire in the public. Now, let me just say, Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon is, in general, supportive of the notion of separation of church and state. And we would not, for instance, I think, want to push for prayer in the public schools. It's just our sense that here we have a situation where hiring discrimination comes up against another principle, which is separation of church and state. And it's our sense that the mere wearing of religious garb does not in and of itself impose religion on students. Or I think Charlie probably has a different view on this, but we think it doesn't amount to proselytizing. Mm-hmm. And given that the growing diversity of our state, the changing cultural and religious diversity of our state, it's important to make sure that our public schools are open to that diversity and in some sense represent and include that diversity in the educational process.
Well, how do we then affirm this cultural and ethnic diversity in the states while maintaining religious neutrality, Mr. Hinkle?
Well, I think this really goes to the core of the debate about how you deal with religion in the public schools. It's my view and generally the view of the American Civil Liberties Union that it is permissible and necessary for schools to teach about religion and to honor the various religious ceremonies and holidays of the various religions, so that people understand what Hanukkah is, and people understand what Ramadan is, and people understand what Christmas is. I think it's important for the public schools to teach those things. What we are concerned about, what I am concerned about, I guess I should say, is the effect on children. I think in all the discussions that I've had over the last couple of months and debating various people on this issue, from the proponents for the repeal of the statute, you hear very little, if anything, about the rights of the children. There are studies that indicate that, for example, a Roman Catholic student, and the younger the student, the greater the problem, a Roman Catholic student who is being tested by a teacher who is wearing a cross will score higher on that test than if that same Roman Catholic student is being tested by a teacher who's wearing a Star of David, and vice versa, that students, the younger the student, the more impressionable they are, obviously, but younger students in particular are influenced by the sense of belongingness and the sense of being an outsider, the sense of being identifying with their teacher. And so far as I know, no one has refuted these studies. And it's not just one. I'm familiar with four or five studies that have shown this kind of correlation between the student who is able to identify with the teacher, because we all want to please our teachers. We all want to be like our teacher, in the first and second and third grades. I'm not talking now about 12th graders. Maybe the 12th grader wants to be just the opposite of his teacher.
Right.
But for the youngster, the young kid, the teacher is the most important authority figure in their lives, and they want to be like teacher. If teacher says it's snowing today and mom says it isn't, kid is going to say, well, teacher said, teacher's right.
And that is a critical developmental stage. However, did they do a study on the converse of that? Because coming from a minority perspective, I'm wondering, well, what would they have said about the fact that I am anything other with a teacher who is not like? And so what kinds of encouragement, whether it's subtle or not, does a student who is not like teacher get from teacher? Because you may have a student who is Sikh or who is Muslim or who is Jewish. Did the study cover that aspect of it?
I think the same thing applies, yes, that if the person who is the outsider always has that problem. So, I mean, mm-hmm. you're absolutely right. If you have a multi-religious student body, mm-hmm. then that illustrates my point, why you keep all religious influences out. You should not allow the teacher to be wearing the Christian symbol. You should not be allowing the teacher to wear the Jewish symbol, the Islamic symbol, any symbol, because this teacher should be religiously neutral. Everybody should be able to look at you. I mean, I'm looking at you right now, Celeste. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what your religion is. Mm-hmm. You might be a Christian. You might be a Muslim. I have no idea. You are an African-American woman. That's my first impression of you. But when you see a woman walking in with a burqa mm-hmm. Or a hijab, mm-hmm. your first impression is, gee, that's a pretty – not she's a pretty woman or she's a young woman or she's an old woman. Your first thought is she's a Muslim woman. That's the first thing you think when you see a woman wearing the religious dress of the Muslim faith.
And well, let's hold that thought right there. I need to get the station ID and then identify you two. And I want to talk a little bit, too, about how we perceive dress. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city. And this is More Talk Radio. You can join in the conversation by calling 503-231-8187. It's 8:25 here, and we're speaking with Kevin Finney of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon and Charlie Hingle. I almost want to say attorney to the world, you know, but because you cover such a broad range of topics, and we're discussing the some of the nuances and some of the challenges behind the Senate Bill 786 implementation. And how it has left the public school teachers here in Oregon uncovered or not. Please join us in the conversation. You can call and discuss with us your thoughts on it. And I wanted to go back to what you were saying about dress. One of the conversations Cecil and I had was, well, a lot of our dress, our clothing, our attitudes have kind of like an overlay, and that's our cultural overlay. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I had wondered is, well, is some of the way we look at attire really kind of American-centric perspective, because we assume that certain aspects of clothing only has a religious significance as opposed to a broader cultural significance. For example, when you look at the hijab or the whole idea of wearing a veil, that actually predates Islam.
Right.
And so could one also say, I am just representing my cultural milieu as opposed to my spiritual milieu? Because I wonder, especially since given the fact that for some people, the wearing of certain clothing is not necessarily a sign of religious or spiritual devotion. It could be a... it could be their way of perhaps protecting identity or expressing modesty or privacy or anything, which doesn't have to be limited to a spiritual component. It could be a secular value as well.
Well, there always are, in any the application of any law, there are always hard questions on the margins. But the Oregon Supreme Court, in construing this statute, said that the question of what is religious dress has both an objective and a subjective component. That mm-hmm. is, it's both what is the wearer's intent,
right,
and what is the observer's perception. Mm-hmm. As I said a moment ago, if I see a woman walking in here with a burqa, my first thought is Muslim woman. Not she's upholding the culture of her foreparents, centuries ago. My first thought is she is communicating something about her religion. Now, there may be, as I say, a close question where it may be a close question whether something is cultural or religious. But, 99% of the time, that's not going to be an issue. This statute was originally passed in the 1920s, addressed to nuns, Roman Catholic nuns, right, who at that time, we all remember, or some of us remember, we're old, were very distinctive in their public garb, wearing the black from top stem to stern with the very prominent headdress. So there was no question about religious garb in those years. Kevin, do you think feel differently about that? Or?
I'm not sure what you mean when you say there was no question about it in those years. But
well, the religious dress, you know, if you looked at a Roman Catholic nun, you thought Roman Catholic nun. You mm-hmm. thought religion. You didn't think, gee, that's a cultural manifestation.
No, I think that's right. But but yet I do think it, this question raises some important issues. I mean, when is a wearing of a scarf a religious act and when is it a cultural act? If mm-hmm. if its inclusion as a religious practice is primarily because of a kind of support for a sense of modesty, if on the one hand a Muslim woman wears it because she's religiously observant, and another woman who may be an ex-Muslim wears it because she feels like she supports the idea of modesty, even though she no longer holds to the faith, and another woman wears it, you know, because she's in a rock band and her rock band thinks it's really cool, you know, are you going to say that, well, one can and one can't wear the exact same piece of apparel? I think that's a concern and an issue, you know, and I think the problem is not that we certainly want to keep our schools as places that are religiously neutral. And we don't want any young students feeling like they have to perform to a certain religious standard in order to be successful. And I think that there are protections because we have the Establishment Clause of the Constitution in place, because we have teacher performance standards here in our state. And you know, there's not, I don't see that most students, especially, you know, but the ACLU has put a lot of emphasis on whether we need to have this statewide statute banning the wearing of all religious attire to protect young students. But I have a couple of youngsters of my own, and I know that at this stage, they are impressionable, but they're also questioning. And they come home and they ask lots of questions about things their teacher says and goes on, and the parents have an opportunity to give feedback on that. As long as the attire is just being worn and it's not going along with some proselytizing message, which I assume would still be banned by the Establishment Clause, I think maybe too much is being made of the threat from the mere wearing of attire. I just want to make one other quick point. Charlie, in his comments, talked about the wearing of a cross, the wearing of a Star of David in regard to this study. Those are actually allowed under the Cooper decision that was made in 86, I think it was, which indicated that the wearing of a small indicia, some jewelry of that regard, was not necessarily a problem under the statute. I know Charlie would like to see the statute interpreted more broadly than the court did, but that's what the Supreme Court has said, and it raises an issue of whether, you know, a Christian can be hired and wear the cross, but a Muslim woman who wants to wear the scarf, hijab, isn't hired. Do we have a problem there of discrimination against religious minorities that really does need to be addressed?
I think that's a very good point. And I'm not sure how I feel about broadening the statute to include crosses. I think maybe it should be. I mean, the Oregon Supreme Court wasn't passing judgment on the wisdom of it. It simply said when the statute bans religious dress, that means dress. It means apparel. It doesn't mean jewelry. Now, maybe the statute should cover jewelry. Because my concern, frankly, is, as a practical one, if this statute is repealed and you start getting Muslim women or Jewish men wearing their religious garb in the school, you're going to have pushback from the conservative Christian elements, the conservative Christian teachers, the conservative Christians in general in our society, who already feel that their religion is under siege. I mean, just listen to Bill O'Reilly the past week about how Christmas is under siege again. Christmas is under attack. The conservative Christians think that they are the persecuted minority in this country. And if you have a woman wearing her hijab as a Muslim woman in the public schools, I think it's going to be very hard to say to that Christian woman, you can't wear something that proclaims your religious identity. There was a federal case just a couple of years ago in Pennsylvania involving a woman who wanted to wear a T-shirt to school that said Jesus 2000, just proclaiming her faith that year. And I think the potential for religious conflict in the public schools, which has always been there, is going to be accentuated if this statute is repealed and you start getting the manifestations of some religions in the public schools. You're going to get manifestations by Christians as well.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. I'm here with my co-host, Celeste Carey. We're speaking this morning with attorney Charlie Hinkle and Kevin Finney of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon on a proposal in the Oregon legislature which will allow public school teachers to wear religious attire. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. We invite your calls to participate in this conversation. And let's go to a caller who's been waiting for a while. Good morning. Good morning, Mark. Thank you for your patience.
Good morning. I have a couple of questions for the lawyer. One is based on garb. You know, the Christians are already, and I say the Christians, meaning the majority of people in this country are Christian, kind of arguing the point that religious garb should be allowed in schools, already hold the majority and therefore would sort of control the situation in general. And I wanted to get some response on that. And then the second question would be, as far as scheduling of the calendar year goes with our schools, isn't it set up for the majority of Christian faith anyway? And how does that tie in with the whole garb thing?
Well, on your first point, there's no doubt that ever, as long as there have been public schools in this country, there have been efforts by religious groups, primarily because of our history, it's been primarily Christian groups. As long as there have been public schools, there have been efforts by Christians to use the public schools to promote their faith. They've wanted their prayers to be uttered. They've wanted their sacred texts to be read. They've wanted their Ten Commandments posted on the walls of the public school classroom. When you hear people like Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell saying they want prayer in the public schools, they're not talking about Buddhist prayers or Islamic prayers or Jewish prayers. You never hear Pat Robertson say, gee, I'd like to hear a good Muslim prayer in the public schools. What he wants is Christian prayers in the public schools. And, I mean, you're absolutely right in pointing out that the Christians are the majority religion in this country. And if you allow people to start wearing religious garb in the public schools, it's going to be 999-1 that it's going to be Christian religious garb that's being worn because they are in the majority. Now, in terms of the second part of your question, the accommodating or the school schedule, I don't know all the reasons. I mean, one of the main reasons we have summer vacation and school starting and stopping when it does was that kids had to work on the farm and the fields to help harvest the crops. But certainly the Christmas holiday was an accommodation for Christians. But now I think most schools, if there's a significant population of a given religion, the schools adjourn for that day. I mean, there's no school in Brooklyn on Rosh Hashanah. And Jewish students now can take their Jewish holidays off. So I don't, you know, that's part of the accommodation that government does and should make to religious belief.
There are some sort of statutes involved so that children can take off different religious holidays. For example, I want my son to be exposed to as many religious viewpoints as possible. And it would be very difficult, I don't know, to argue that, I think. I mean, you know, if I want to take off.
Well, I mean, I suppose there's a religious holiday in some religion every day of the year. So if you're going to acknowledge every religion a holiday, you're not going to have any school. But, you know, Christmas should be a teachable moment. Hanukkah should be a teachable moment. Ramadan should be a teachable moment. What do these religious holidays mean, and why are they celebrated, and how are they celebrated? As I said at the beginning, I think it's important for public schools to teach that sort of thing without promoting them.
Thank you, Mark. Kevin, do you have any comments in terms of some of the issues the caller raised?
Yes. I just think that the mistake to avoid here. I mean, one thing that's interesting about Oregon is that Oregon is often referred to as the nun state, meaning when people are asked what their religious viewpoints are, affiliations, they reply none, to a much larger extent than much of the rest of the country. I think in some ways, the fact that we're a state that has increasing cultural and religious diversity, and at the same time a state that has a lot of people who aren't strongly attached to religion, may make this somewhat less threatening, opening up the wearing of some religious apparel in the public schools than it would be if you were in an area that was predominantly and kind of overwhelmingly fundamentalist Christian in its nature, or had some other very strong dominant religious viewpoint that would lead to members of other minority religions really being kind of at, you know, a threat that a whole school might start wearing the same religious apparel, say. And I think it's also a mistake to see what we're doing. We're not passing a bill sort of directing or allowing the wearing of religious apparel. We're removing a statewide statute that bans the wearing of any religious apparel. And so there will still be Establishment Clause protections in place. Schools will still have a responsibility to maintain religious neutrality. This doesn't just throw open the gates to any possible combination. I mean, Charlie mentioned the wearing of a T-shirt saying Jesus 2000. You know, my sense would be that that would not be allowed just because we've removed this statewide statute banning religious apparel. I've sort of encouraged, I talked to David Fedanke, the executive director of the ACLU. I encouraged them to think about coming forward with some new language that would not have the effect of banning all religious apparel in the classroom, but would really have the effect of banning with the wearing of religious apparel that was proselytizing in nature. Our view is that there's a distinction between wearing a piece of clothing as an act of piety and wearing a piece of clothing that really directly tries to recruit others to your faith or convey an overt message. So I think that's what I would want to say here about that issue.
That raises some interesting points. Something that we all talked about earlier was whether so-called religious garb is limited to just a religious expression or broader cultural interpretation. And one of the things that is an effect of us becoming a more multicultural nation is the fact that we adopt different modes of dress from cultures. I don't know how many people have noticed that nowadays it's very common to see young people who are not Muslim or Islamic in the least wearing prayer shawls and wear them as a accoutrement. You know, basically, it's a fashion statement. Have we considered how there is a conscious change in how we use clothing, which could nullify the whole idea of being able to make a subjective or a more direct interpretation of what a person means from wearing some clothing, and the fact that maybe we do need to look at it more as the overt message?
Well, you know, perception is a funny thing because it is so subjective. How a person perceives another person and mm-hmm. what that person is wearing. Some kind of clothing is perceived as threatening or frightening to some people. I mean, when you see a kid walking down the street with his jeans slung below his rear end, what kind of message, A, is he intending, and B, what kind of message is being received by another person? Think of the Christmas tree. The Christmas tree originated as a completely secular thing in Germany or something. It was sort of co-opted as part of the Christian holiday brought to England by Queen Victoria's husband in the 1830s or something like that. No one had heard of the Christmas tree as a Christian symbol before that, at least not in English and American society. And for most Christians, I expect, they don't see the tree as a religious symbol at all. And yet I have some Jewish friends who perceive it entirely as a religious symbol, a symbol of the Christian holiday, and they get quite resentful that a public school would have a Christmas tree but not a menorah or something. And that's why there is a Jewish group in Portland that insists on having its menorah down at Pioneer Square every year during this time of year, because they want to counterbalance what they perceive as the Christian symbol. You know, when I see a girl, a woman, or a man for that matter, wearing a little cross around their neck, I don't think, gee, that's a strong Christian person. I think that's a nice piece of jewelry. But to certain people, seeing that cross is an immediate symbol and sign and affirmation of their Christian faith.
So, even if it's worn by a heavy metal goth youth?
Well, exactly. I mean, not to me, but some people look at the cross and think that's the symbol of the religion that thinks I killed their Savior, and by golly, that's an offensive religious symbol to me.
So there is no context. You're saying that we're so patterned that we don't think in terms of the context expressed.
Well, you do, but I mean, I mean, this is where Kevin and I disagree a little bit, and perhaps you and I too, Celeste. The question of proselytizing. Uh-huh. When a woman is wearing the hijab in class, she's communicating a message. We all communicate a message by the clothing that we wear. We intend to present a certain photo to the world. I'm a lawyer, and I don't wear ratty jeans downtown when I'm going to court. I want to project a certain image as a lawyer. It's a necessary part of the image. We want our police officers to project a certain image. That Muslim woman who's wearing a hijab is not doing it necessarily because she thinks God is impelling her. She's doing it as an expression of her faith, and she wants to communicate that to somebody else. I mean, it reminds me of the people who say, this, again, the fundamentalist Christians who say, well, why can't we start the school day or why can't we start the day with prayer? My answer to that is start the day with prayer. Pray all you want. Pray all day long in your classrooms. Just don't force me to listen to your prayers. Because people who want vocal public prayer in the public school classroom are not doing it because they're afraid God won't hear them if they pray silently. They want someone else to hear their prayer. They want you to hear their prayer. And when a woman is wearing a hijab, she may be doing it for her own personal purposes, but she wants you to be aware that she's doing it for her own personal purposes. Because there may be two Muslim women side by side, equally devout, equally sincere, equally orthodox. One is wearing that hijab, one is not. And the one who is wearing it is because she wants to make a statement to the public.
Well, it seems that at least, and this is an ongoing conversation in terms of what people assumptions are, how people actions are perceived. And what I also hear, you know, we often hear in many discussions the slippery slope and how to measure that. We are speaking this morning with Charlie Hinkle, Portland attorney, and Kevin Finney, public policy director at Ecumenical Ministries, about a proposal at the Oregon State Legislature which will allow public school teachers to wear religious garb. Our phone numbers are 503-231-8187. And let's go to the next caller online. Crystal is not there right now, but we'll go to the next caller online at this moment. Good morning, caller.
Good morning.
Something comes to mind here, and I'm thinking, I don't know that there's a particular dress for Satanism or witchcraft. So at what point does it create more problems, I think, in allowing certain religious dress? Because then wouldn't you have to accommodate me if my religion is Satanism or witchcraft?
Well, sure. You certainly couldn't discriminate among religions. I mean, Kevin pointed out earlier that there are only three states in the union that have these statutes. But the reason it doesn't come up in any other state or most other states is that local school boards have their own comparable policies. I mean, I don't know of any school district in America now where the wearing of religious dress is encouraged. But, you know, we haven't had, I mean, let's just face the historic demographic fact, we haven't had a large presence of Muslim women seeking to be public school teachers until now. I mean, because as everybody says, everybody acknowledges, we are, you know, beginning to be a much more pluralistic nation than we used to be. I mean, 200 years ago, pluralism meant you were either Christian or not. A little later, pluralism meant you were either Catholic, Protestant, or Jew. But now, pluralism means that you can be one of any of 100 or 1,000 religions in our society. So, yes, there's no question that the wearing of religious dress in the public school is going to, if this statute is repealed, and Oregonians being as litigious as they are and as aggressive in promoting their own rights, we're going to see some very interesting lawsuits or public policy discussions about what is and is not religious garb and who's allowed to wear it. I just wish that the people who are so concerned about asserting their own rights were equally concerned about the perception and the effect on children of this.
Kevin, response in terms of if you allow someone to wear religious garb, it might be something that's personally offensive to my family.
Well, you know, I think I generally hold to the feeling that just because something is personally offensive, it doesn't, to some people, doesn't mean it should necessarily be illegal. I think that, you know, there may be instances in which somebody has a symbol of Satanism tattooed in their wrist, or, you know, they wear some kind of a button on their shirt or something. I certainly would not endorse that as a personal practice, but I'm not sure I want to make it illegal as a matter of public policy if that means that we prevent the hiring of people from a broad range of minority religious viewpoints.
There's been, as we wind down the hour, it has been hinted earlier that there's been a history of people of faith and ecumenical ministries of Oregon and civil libertarians working on a broad range of issues. Opposition to the death penalty, support for undocumented workers, support for anti-discrimination laws, and other human and civil rights issues. This seems to be a divide between normal allies.
Is there any potential of bridge building or consensus building in this arena?
Well, I certainly think there is, and I mean, my sense is that there's a lot of internal discussion about this topic going on within the ACLU, amongst members of the ACLU board. There's different viewpoints. I know that, you know, we've had a lot of internal discussion about the topic. Our feeling, as I say, is not that we want to throw open the schools to religious proselytizing, not that we think we should abandon the principle of religious neutrality in the schools, but simply that we think that the hiring discrimination that's at work here is important. You know, this statute that we're talking about, ORS 342-650, dates back to the 1920s when a guy named Caspar K. Kubley, who was a member affiliated with the KKK, the Klan, brought this forth as an anti-Catholic kind of measure. We think its history is tainted. We think its effect is negative. You know, this is why not only Speaker Dave Hunt, but also State Superintendent of Schools Susan Castillo and Labor Commissioner Brad Avakian have joined in sending a letter to the legislature calling for the repeal of this statute. There's been letters sent by the Sikh American Legal Defense and Education Fund to the U.S. Department of Justice asking Attorney General Holder to look into whether this might be a violation of anti-discrimination provisions at the federal level, and at least some acknowledgement on the part of the DOJ that they are going to look into that question. So we think that we need to balance here the interest in keeping religious neutrality in the schools with recognizing the increasing cultural diversity of our state and allowing and eliminating sort of discrimination in hiring against people of a minority religious point of view.
Well, I certainly believe in religious liberty as well, and in exercise of religious freedom. I'm the lawyer who, for the last 9 years, has been litigating the longest running religious liberty case in the history of the state of Oregon. So, I have very strong bona fides in that area. Public school teachers do not have free speech rights in the classroom. We do not allow public school teachers to address their first graders or their eighth graders or their 12th graders on their personal beliefs about abortion or President Obama or health care or vegetarianism. Public school teachers are hired to teach algebra. They can't talk about vegetarianism if they're hired to teach algebra. So we already acknowledge that free speech rights can be restricted in the public school classroom. And to say that we can restrict free exercise of religion rights in the public school classroom should be equally acceptable, it seems to me. The free exercise of religion is a precious right, but it is no more precious than free speech. And if we say to public school teachers, as I think universally acknowledged, that a public school teacher has no right to free speech in the classroom, then it should not be offensive to anyone to say that their religious liberty rights are also restricted in that forum. Wear your hijab all you want, 20 hours a day, but the 4 hours you are in that classroom, you can't wear it. Go outside and proclaim your political beliefs on Bush or Obama or climate change or whatever, 20 hours a day, but not in those 4 hours when you're talking to a captive audience of young, impressionable students.
Let's go to one last call before we leave for this time, this conversation. Good morning, caller. Let's go to the next call. Good morning, caller.
Yes, hello. Quickly, I just wanted to say that right now there's no neutrality in school on religion because every Halloween, they celebrate Halloween in school, and to me, that's the antithesis of Christianity. It's witchcraft, and teachers and the whole public school express witchcraft in school, and nothing is being said about it. So there's no neutrality. Satan is allowed to express himself in school right now. So,
well, just so you know, there are a lot of public high schools and grade schools here in Portland, Oregon, that do not celebrate Halloween.
But a lot of them, but they have the option, though. I mean, every school that my child has been in, they on Halloween day, they wear their Halloween costumes to school if they choose to. They got Halloween.
So you're saying that you let them wear their costumes to school?
I'm just saying they have the option to do that if they want to. There's nothing restricting Halloween from being expressed in public schools, and I think that is demonology and witchcraft. And
okay, but I just wanted to say, bear in mind as we kind of wrap this up, you said you send your kids to school dressed that way, so the way you presented it makes it sound as though you also celebrate this holiday.
Well, that was a misspeak. I'm saying the school that she go to, the kids go that way, and it has nothing, it doesn't differ from the fact that that exists in public schools, and so my point is there is no neutrality.
Well, okay. I see your point.
All right, thank you.
Well, I think that illustrates my point that you know the more we allow any kind of religious expression in the public schools, the more pushback there's going to be from people, from conservative Christians who perceive the whole public school regime as it exists now as sort of secular state and anti-Christian. I mean, you should read the statements by the lieutenant governor of South Carolina last year defending a license plate that said, "I believe," with a cross behind it. Why, we are the persecuted minority. Everybody in this country has free speech rights except us poor persecuted Christians. I tell you, the pushback from these conservative Christians who believe their religion is under siege by the secular state are going to take advantage of this law much more than any Muslim or Sikh woman is going to.
We're winding down. Kevin?
Your comments, Carmen? Kevin?
Well, you know, again, first of all, I think the Halloween example kind of illustrates how different things could mean a lot of different things to different people. I think for most kids today, Halloween is a fun time to dress up, to do dress up, and it may be that you dress up as a monster. It may be that you dress up as a princess. It may be that you dress up as a frog or a cartoon character. You know, it's in its own way, Halloween is a kind of symbol of increasing diversity, and that's what this issue is about for us, recognizing the increasing diversity out there in the public.
We want to thank Kevin Finney of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon and Charlie Hingo, Portland attorney, for coming in today to speak about this issue. It's an ongoing conversation, and we will not settle it this morning, but we encourage you to continue conversations in your community. My name is Cecil Prescott.
I'm Celeste Carey, and we will hear you next week.